You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, August 30th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, quickie from David Dayan on one element of the TPP's investor-state dispute settlement system that is both incredibly problematic and unreported. Also on the program today, primaries in Florida, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Tim Canova, we shall see, Alan Grayson, Scott Murphy, we shall see, and John McCain hoping to eke it out in Arizona. Paul LePage, the governor of Maine, the governor of Jimmy Reefer Cake. Will he be exiting stage lunatic? NASA reports that the Earth is now warming at a pace that is unprecedented over the last 1,000 years. And for some reason, well, not for some reason, amid threats to their safety, USDA offices around the country are shut down. Unclear as to what the threat, who it's from. Justice Department, it's a week old, folks, but not for me. Shutting down, or I should say, stopping the privatization of their prisons. Most of them, most of the private prisons are state-owned, but it's a good start. And what's her first name? Andrea Tantaros? Challenges a series of Fox liars to take a lie detector test. And the questions themselves may very well be revealing. Heartwarming tale of a James O'Keefe fail. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. I am back from vacation, as you know. What is that buzzing? What's that? Is that Michael's? Kelly. Kelly's mic is buzzing. Oh, that's what it was. Wire. What is that wire? Your buzzing wire? Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be back from vacation. My eczema has died down now, and my child's lice infection and Coxsackie infections have receded. So all in time to return back from vacation. So happy to be here. The eczema has basically, the upper half of my body is now fine. The toes and the ankles, still a bit of a problem, but you can't see that, and hopefully you won't be able to hear it. Here we are. We are less than a week away from Labor Day. This is traditionally when early September would be when the campaigns begin to reveal themselves in some fashion. It's already quite clear what these campaigns are about at this juncture. We are less than a month away from the first debate, assuming it happens. We hear reports of the Clinton camp now bringing in everyone from Donald Trump's former ghostwriter to a team of psychologists to see what exactly will really get under Donald Trump's skin. Donald Trump, meanwhile, all he's doing, I think, is, I mean, God knows. He's probably just sitting on top of practicing being able to say Bill Clinton is an enabler or something like that. Or it's just going to get crazier from here on out, I believe. I mean, I know since we've been gone, Kellyanne Conway is now the campaign manager. Paul Manafort, I guess, has been sent back to Kiev. And this guy Bannon from Breitbart is also a chief consigliere of the campaign. So, you know, we will be obviously covering the campaign going forward, but there's a lot of other stories that are important that are happening in the meantime. And one of them is the TPP. During the course of Michael, you got to turn down Michael's microphone because it's not on a button. One of the things that took place just after a days that we left on to vacation, or I guess on that Friday, was that it was, and I think we had announced it, that President Obama had basically signaled or formally signaled to Congress that he was going to be offering up the TPP for ratification in the lame duck session. And that, of course, is a formal requirement under the TPA, which is the basically the fast track authority, meaning that there can be no amendments in the House, there can be no filibusters in the Senate. It only needs a 50 plus one vote to ratify. But one of those provisions was that you needed to give at least a minimum of 30 days of before you bring the vote. Everyone had anticipated there would be no vote before the election because you have two presidential candidates who are very strongly, at least rhetorically, in both instances, I would say, there's reason for skepticism against the TPP. So it was very unlikely this vote was going to happen before the election. And the plan was for the Obama administration to bring this to a vote, or hope to bring it to the vote in the lame duck section, session, I should say. The Obama administration has been planning a roadshow, which is annoying, because I thought the Obama administration didn't realize they could do these things when they wanted to advocate for one of their policies. Seemed unable to do it in the run-up to the Affordable Care Act to save the public option. I'm being sarcastic. They didn't want to do that. And my only tweet on the matter was that he must think he's Green Lantern now. I think I made that comment with David Dayan. Green Lantern theory is what they say when you very important, very serious people, villagers, suggest that you're asking the president to do something he can't do. He's not Green Lantern. He's just the president. Now, I don't know why they say Green Lantern as opposed to Superman or Flash, but I think that was probably a way for guys who perceive themselves as nerds to sort of pick a superhero that wasn't the obvious one. As a kid, I read Green Lantern. I didn't particularly enjoy it either, frankly. I was more of a Firestorm guy. Nevertheless,
goddamn right.
That's right. Nevertheless,
important texture there.
Well, yes. Nevertheless, they're sending out a bunch of cabinet folks to really cross many states. I don't know how they're picking it out. Maybe places where they thought there would be Republican opposition, or to shore up the 28 Democrats in the House who voted for the TPA, who all apparently seem to be willing to vote for the TPP. John Kerry's going to hit the road. Ashton B. Carter, the Secretary of Defense, retired Admiral Michael Mullen, former chair of the Joint Chiefs under George Bush and Obama. Mullen, I should say. Admiral Harry B. Harris, Jr. Because part of the argument here is that, I mean, And I go through this with David. We recorded this about an hour ago. But the security arguments are that we need to show the Pacific Rim countries that we are faithful partners with them on all fronts, and that the only way to convince them of this, that we've got their backs on a security level, even though we've got treaties that are decades old to protect people from the potential or non-potential aggressiveness of China, even though we have shifted all of our naval fleet, not all, but a huge amount of our naval fleet has been reoriented to the Pacific. There is an argument out there floating, and this is why presumably they're sending out generals, that we need this for national security reasons. There was an op-ed I saw the other day by a former brigadier general in the Army saying, well, you know, the other problem on these, the other problem with passing the TPP from a security standpoint is that the Pentagon has already issued that one of the greatest threats to our national security is our deindustrialization. We don't have the ability to make weapons, I guess, presumably, in the event that we were involved in some type of large-scale war. So I don't know if I buy this security argument at all, frankly. I particularly am not terribly concerned about a large-scale war, but maybe that's 50 years down the road. Who knows? Nevertheless, Mitch McConnell came out the other day, and maybe it was yesterday, and basically said, "We're not gonna raise this in the Senate during the lame duck session." And on Friday, Bernie Sanders, Jeff Merkley, came out and applauded McConnell's decision to not bring this to the Senate floor. Now, I don't know if you want to trust Mitch McConnell, but the idea of Sanders and Merkley coming out and saying that we have bipartisan consent, agreement that we shouldn't bring this to the floor. Look, it can still happen. And it can still happen in a Clinton administration as well. So these arguments as to what is wrong with the TPP are really important. And the more this stuff gets cemented, both on the right and the left, the harder it's going to be for... Because remember, Hillary Clinton is also not Green Lantern. She needs a House and a Senate to vote for the TPP so that she can sign it. So even if you have the most skeptical of perspectives on Clinton's commitment against the TPP, recall that the one thing that's working in our favor is that the last thing the Republicans are going to want to do is give her that if she wants it. So it appears that the TPP won't come up. Nevertheless, David Dayen has written an important piece on one element of the investor state dispute settlement process. And let's go to that now. Also, I should just mention, there's a big deep dive. Part one is like a 40-minute read on BuzzFeed about the TPP. And so we'll look into maybe having that person on over the next week or two. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, David Dayen on the TPP. We're back on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to this program a writer for more publications, frankly, than we have time to name. But most recently, writing in the Huffington Post, a piece that I've heard you say was going to come out a little bit later, but sort of in the wake of BuzzFeed putting out a major series on the TPP. You came out with yours, and I think this covers some ground that the BuzzFeed thing may or may not get to. But David Dayan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Sam.
So, all right, David, let's talk about this. I think, right now, really, literally over the past week and a half, we have seen some really interesting things happening as to whether or not the TPP is going to be brought up during the lame duck session. According to Mitch McConnell, not going to happen.
Yeah.
But according to the 28 Democrats who voted for the Fast Track Authority, they'll vote for TPP. Obama going on a campaign-style campaign. He must think he's Green Lantern, that he can get this thing going. But with that said, let's talk about the substance. You delved into one aspect of the TPP, which I think my audience is somewhat familiar with, but not this element of it, and that centers around the investor-state dispute settlement system. Tell us what that system is.
Right. So investor-state dispute settlement is a feature of over 3,000 current trade agreements and investment treaties that are in force currently. So this system is already set up, and it's basically an international arbitration system. Instead of using a court when there is a dispute with an investment treaty or a trade agreement, corporations, foreign investors in countries that have the ability to access this system can go to this extrajudicial tribunal. So they don't go to the local court. They, if they feel like they are being discriminated against, if they feel like something has violated the trade agreement or violated their treatment, they can go to this court, which is adjudicated by three corporate lawyers who could be working on a case one day and then trying a separate case the next, and they can sue for the loss of expected future profits as a result of whatever treatment was accorded to them.
Let me stop you there and just dig into this a little more. So is there a place, like is there a an investor state dispute settlement Hague, or when we talk about this process existing, is it just like there is a model, a paradigm that is used and it's...
Right. So the investment chapter of all of these treaties has virtually identical language that says in the event of some violation of a minimum standard of treatment or whatever it is, you can appeal to this process. And this process wasn't actually used very much. This process has been around since the post-war era, since the 50s. And the idea of it was that if you're set up a factory in a foreign country and the foreign country just grabs the factory, that you would have an appeals process outside of that local court, which is run by that country. So that was sort of the intention behind it. It has morphed, and this is what I talk about in the piece, into a wholly different institution than what the intention was. It now is a way for rich people to make money, basically, to make it the short version. Because this process is available and the major remedy, the only remedy in the process is a monetary settlement where it's an uncapped monetary settlement where that country has to pay and keep paying this corporation for the loss of expected future profits in perpetuity. So because of that reason, speculators have gotten into this. And they do it in a variety of ways.
Before we get into, just give me one more second. Before we get into the means and the speculation, so let's just be clear here. So there is no international civil court, as it were. I mean, we have an international criminal court. Different countries subscribe to it. I think at this point we don't necessarily subscribe to it for reasons that have to do with the Iraq invasion, as far as I can tell. But there is no international civil court. Is that?
Yeah, well, there There is, but not for the specific purpose. So there's the World Trade Organization, which can settle trade disputes from between countries. So there's a country-to-country process where a country on behalf of its corporations could say, hey, you are violating this trade agreement and you're hurting this corporation, and we need to settle that. So that's the WTO. This is where the corporation can sue the country. They don't have to wait for their government to file some claim on their behalf.
And that's what's distinct too.
The country.
And that's what's distinct too of the TPP versus, let's say, NAFTA or just the WTO. In NAFTA, you started to see this migration where you don't need your own country to bring the action on your behalf.
Well, as I said, this has been in place since the 50s. NAFTA was notable because it was really the first instance of Western developed countries engaging in an agreement with this kind of ISDS system in place. TPP would also further expand that, and then if you do the U.S.-European Union deal, which is known as TTIP, you get from a situation where U.S.-owned assets in foreign countries or foreign countries directly investing in the U.S. is covered right now by maybe 20. ISDS covers maybe 20% of those situations. If you pass TPP and TTIP, it would cover 90% of those situations. So
because presumably in the past,
really blanket it.
Presumably in the past, if you had a claim against the United States government, you could come to a U.S. civil court and file that claim. We are not subject to coups and whatnot, and we have a judiciary that is supposedly independent from what our government officials would do. So in some ways, when you're talking about the United States or Canada or other more developed and stable countries, this is theoretically redundant.
Yeah, theoretically. But the difference is that the rules behind this particular system are far different than a regular court. First of all, there's no transparency. We know of 696 different ISDS cases that have been brought, 10% of those just in the last year, so it's growing as a practice. But even the UN agency that tracks this says we don't know all the cases. They don't have to be publicly made available. The judges do not, they don't have set salaries. They don't have to disclose their ties. There is no transparency around that process. And, there's no judicial review. There's no appeals process. When a ruling from the ISDS arbitration panel comes down, it is treated as if it's constitutional law, basically. There are enforcement mechanisms in these treaties to get the countries to pay up if they lose one of these cases. And the awards are very, very large, much larger than you would see in a regular court process. If a corporation challenges the law in a U.S. court, what happens is the law gets overturned. That's what judicial review is. If they challenge it in ISDS, they get a bunch of money. So it's a totally different process and a totally different system. And the fact that it's so centered on monetary awards is why it's led to this speculation.
Okay, so to explain how the speculation runs, because I have seen, I guess, sort of a version of this in the context of tort cases, where you have an attorney or a plaintiff who doesn't have the resources, let's say, a company has poisoned the water in this guy's backyard. He doesn't have the money to go against this company, but it's quite clear that if he was to win, he would make a lot of money. So someone else steps in and says, we'll bankroll the lawsuit for 10 or 15% or whatever it is. That's the dynamic. How is that different here?
Yeah, it's similar, but that's only one component of it. So you have third-party financing, which is what you were talking about, where an investor decides they're going to bankroll the ISDS case in this instance, for a corporation, keep it off their books, keep it off their balance sheet, keep it under wraps, keep it secret, because that third-party relationship doesn't need to be disclosed in any way in the eyes of the S Corp, and they get a portion of the profits if it succeeds. However, I mean, first of all, there's an entire like financial industry based on that. There are litigation finance firms that are participating in this process, and they say that arbitration claims against a foreign sovereign government are among the fastest growing aspects of the business. So you have this, and usually who the people are doing the investing are hedge funds, private equity firms, institutional investors. But there's another aspect to this where the hedge funds or the private equity firms eliminate the middleman. They just go ahead and buy a company that they think is going to have an ISDS claim in the future, and they buy a major stake in it, and then they bring the claim, even though, in most of the cases, years after the conduct had already started. So the examples I give in the piece are there was a case against Greece that was made by a Slovakian bank that bought up Greek bonds and then said, well, the value of our Greek bonds went down, and that's discriminatory, so we want money for the rest of the value of the bonds. Well, the Greek bonds had been falling for years before that Slovakian bank bought those bonds. So that this was a strategy of theirs that we're going to buy these bonds, and our backstop for the value of them is to use this extrajudicial process through a trade agreement that Slovakia has with Greece, and we're going to use that in order to make a bunch of money. You saw the same thing in Spain, where two subsidiaries, investment firm subsidiaries of major global banks, purchased shares in solar companies, solar power plants. 3 years after Spain, because of its financial crisis, started rolling back its solar subsidies. So they knew that they weren't getting the solar subsidies. There was a rollback in place, and the rollback continued. But they sued in the ISDS courts to say, hey, we didn't know that those solar subsidies were going away, and that's a change and a violation, and we're going to have to get back our expected future profits. So it's not just third-party financing. It's first-party financing, I guess you could call it. It's purchasing a company for the sole purpose of using this process to make money.
So the real, this is interesting because we've talked about the concept of I'm a drug manufacturer and I am selling drugs to the United States, and then all of a sudden we get single payer and they start negotiating prices down on those drugs and I complain, you have cost me future profits. In this instance, someone could show up a year after a single payer has
right.
been instituted and say, like, We're gonna pursue this loss essentially because we know we're gonna make up three times that loss by suing essentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and it leads to a lot of speculative business where the people who are getting rewarded by this process aren't the ones who actually invested in the foreign country, who created jobs, created a factory. It's just the financial industry using it as an asset strategy. You can see all sorts of implications from that, whether they use a secondary market to make this ISDS claim into a tradable asset.
Right, securities, right? They do this with lawsuits now, but at least in the context of the lawsuits, there's an actual loss. And it
right.
is not the defendant in this case is not the taxpayer, right? I mean, because
right.
All of this money, if I go and I sue the United States government because you went and instituted single payer health care and I had anticipated, I hadn't taken any moves in that direction. But generally speaking, I had anticipated the billions of dollars in profits on these drugs that are now the profit margins much lower. I sue you and basically the taxpayer has got to pay for the benefit that their government has given them twice.
And typically the governments that are subject to this thing, you see a lot of piling on that goes on. And it's usually governments that are in a distressed position that can't really fight back. The number one country that has been subject to ISDS cases is Argentina. And most of them are around the emergency measures that they put in when they were in an economic crisis. And the companies that were invested in there that had the ability to bring a case said that, oh, those emergency measures cut into my profits, and you're going to have to pay me. And they have paid almost $1 billion to corporations over ISDS cases. And you see that they just sort of go around the world, and they find these trouble spots. And it's Greece, and it's Spain, and it's and maybe next it's Puerto Rico, and maybe next it's Detroit or Illinois. Because it's not just federal laws that are at issue here, it's state and local ones. So if you expand the ISDS process through TPP and give more countries like Japan and Australia and you know, countries that have a lot of multinational corporations, you give them the ability to sue the U.S. in these special courts, you're opening up any kind of trouble spot in the country to a tremendous amount of risk, and that's risk to the taxpayer.
And it's interesting. I mean, it's just one more element of what is problematic of the TPP, because this dynamic exists. It's just that you're serving up a whole nother, I guess, petri dish in which this stuff can really.
It's a whole other dimension that turns this dispute resolution system into a casino gaming parlor. And that is extremely problematic in my view. And it's not necessary, let's also add. I mean, these are large corporations investing abroad. Traditionally, what you would do in that instance is if you were worried that you were going to be discriminated or expropriated, you'd buy insurance. And, you know, that risk would be offloaded onto another private company. But now the insurance is the taxpayer, the taxpayer of that country. So the risk has been socialized effectively. And this guarantees that they get a minimum certain level of profit, these corporations and these speculators, these financiers who are coming in and abusing the process.
And we should say that when an insurance company insures you, they have someone come out and investigate your claim. In this instance, right, there's no representative of those who would have to pay.
Well, I mean, there sort of is. The way it works is that there's an arbitration panel of three judges. And the one judge is picked by the corporation, one judge is picked by the company, and then they agree on the third judge.
By the country. One is by the country.
The country does get to pick one of the three judges, and then they agree on the third. However, you know, I mean, one of the things that, you know, U.S. Trade Representative and defenders of the system say is that, well, companies only win a quarter of these cases. First of all, that's only the cases we know about that have been publicly disclosed. And second of all, that doesn't include the cases where the countries settle, where there are undisclosed terms of monetary value given in. If you throw out the cases where jurisdiction, they say, well, we don't have the jurisdiction to hear this case because you're not, you know, based in the country you say you are or whatever it is. You throw out those, and it's a fairly large majority of these cases get decided on behalf of the corporation. And even threatening to bring the case can have a chilling effect, which you know, basically gets in the heads of regulators and says, this is going to cost us a lot of money in legal fees if we go ahead, and we don't have access to a litigation finance system like these corporations do. So it's going to cost us a lot of money, so we better not pass that law, or we better not change that regulation.
Right. There's a chilling effect. I mean, we've seen a dynamic like that basically with Dodd-Frank in some respects, and we see it with the EPA, and we see this all the time. And all right, so two more questions, and then I know you got to run. All right, so won't also, I mean, Isn't it also, I should say, not necessarily predictive of what the rate of success of these corporations pursuing an ISDS claim is? Mm-hmm. Because the TPP could, or it appears that will, institute a new set of rules, I guess, that will be more favorable to those plaintiffs going forward.
It expands the system. Right now, the U.S. has ISDS triggered in bilateral deals with, like, Costa Rica. You know, Costa Rican companies are not super prevalent in the United States.
Right.
But when you expand that deal to include Australia and all their shipping companies, or Japan and all their banks, it's a completely different scenario. And I might add that TPP was a real jackpot for the financial services industry with respect to ISDS, because they got the ability to sue under the most flexible standard, which is called the minimum standard of treatment. And that means that if that bank, that financial services company, isn't accorded the minimum standard of treatment, then they can say that you know, you, the United States, are discriminating against us. And so now you've opened up foreign banks for the ability to you know, sue in these special courts. And if you're talking about Japan, well, you know, every Swiss bank has a subsidiary in Japan. Every U.S. bank, mega bank, has a subsidiary in Japan. They can use those subsidiaries. We've seen that many
those
times.
Those subsidiaries
it venue shopping. Philip Morris wanted to sue Australia over those cigarette regulations that they made, but U.S. and Australia didn't have a deal, so they used a Hong Kong subsidiary and sued under the Hong Kong-Australia Investment Treaty. So this happens all the time, really. This happens where the venues change, and often the arbitrators just wave that through and let that go forward.
All right, so lastly, it's interesting to try and pin down the arguments for the TPP, because you have economists come out and say, like, this is really not even a trade deal.
Right.
And then, you know, there is some argument as, like, we're trying this Asian pivot, and if we don't, you know, and this is part of turning to Asia, as if, you know, the fact that we've moved our entire Navy into the Pacific is not enough of an indication, right? We need to have this protection for pharmaceuticals and
right.
And whatnot. And then there are some who argue that, like, look, the president has gone out on a limb. We need to pass this to save face, all that stuff. Has there been also a lobby behind, like, is there a significant lobby out there going, like, this is going to be a cash cow for us? Like, this is going to be we're going to open up another desk in our business, and it's just going to be this. And so we're going to lobby hard for this.
I mean, I haven't seen definitive evidence of that. What I do know is that the industry that is, you know, engaging in third-party finance is very happy about the recent drift toward investment arbitration. They're making a lot of money off these cases. And so anything that expands it, I assume they would be perfectly fine with. What's interesting is that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as we know, is a big, big supporter of the TPP. However, they're a huge opponent of third-party financing, because often it gets used to file commercial claims against some of their members.
Right.
So they're in this weird position where they're defending the ISDS system, but completely opposed to this system of litigation finance, which has sprung up around the ISDS system.
I'm sure that they can figure out a way of just saying, like, it's one thing to finance corporations, you know, B2B is much different than it would be to finance the lawsuit of an individual.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
David Dayan, I know that you're pressed for time. I know you've been up for a while. I really appreciate you spending some time with us.
All right. Thanks a lot.
The great David Dayan, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we'll have more audio from the, I don't know, soon to be ex-governor Paul LePage. I mean, look, if you are a guy like Paul LePage, you have to be saying to yourself, hey, I could get a job on Trump Media. I mean, anything could happen. So you may actually be thinking to yourself, like, I got to maybe he's saying the stuff just so that he can have a reason to leave. He doesn't want to be like Sarah Palin and just say, I'm just explicitly going for the money now. Maybe he makes it sound like I'm hurting Maine. I'm going to quit. I don't know, 6 weeks before Trump Media launches. It's a theory. We also, of course, have some sound from Rush Limbaugh. And the sound from Trump's doctor, Harold Bornstein, who, I don't know, lunatic. The whole thing is lunacy. I think this poor doctor is just like, there is doctors who, when we would do productions, at one point I executive produced a couple of shows, and one I did in New York City. It was called Beat Cops. This was 17 years ago now, maybe more. And as an executive producer, what I need to do to fulfill my obligations for the insurance on my production is I have to send the major actors in the production to a doctor down the road. You got to turn off his microphone. And so we sent them to a doctor to get a physical, and literally, and I went as an actor too, and literally it was just a guy, that's all he did. It's just like, hey, how you doing? Good. All right. What's the show? It's about two cops. That sounds like fun. You got a headshot? Yeah, I do. Any chance you could send it to me? Just sign it? Yeah. All right. Well, you look good. Thanks for coming by. And that was it. And they would just sign off. And I have a feeling that Trump's doctor, I don't know, maybe he's a very good doctor, but I have a feeling that the nature of the relationship was very similar to that. In fact, let's play Trump's doctor, Harold Bornstein, responding to NBC News questions about his wording of his letter of Trump's health. Because you remember, the wording was like, this guy's the most awesomest, healthiest person I've ever seen. You know, it's a little bit over the top. And not what would you call a clinical representation of someone's health.
He has no history of ever using alcohol or tobacco products. If elected, Mr. Trump, I can say unequivocally, will be the healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency.
Dr. Bornstein, phrases like astonishingly excellent seem a little bit over the top to some people. What do you think about that? Is that the way that you write most of your medical letters?
No, but for Mr. Trump, I wrote that letter that way.
Did he ask you to describe it that way, or do you pick up his kind of language by spending time with him?
I think I probably picked up his kind of language and then just interpreted it to my own.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, as a reporter, like, why do you offer that out? Why don't you wait a little bit more? Just, like, sit there in silence. Like, how do you explain something like that? Or let me give you an answer that will be, you know, somewhat sufficient. But obviously what happened is Trump wrote the letter himself. He probably wrote it himself. And either signed the guy's name or gave it to him to sign. And the guy now is just sort of like, there's no doubt in my mind, like the level of sort of intensity on this campaign was like, Trump's like, hey, Harold, I need a letter. It's fine, right? I'll sign it, whatever you want. Sign it myself, sign it yourself. Don't worry about it. And now all of a sudden it's coming back like, oh, this is real? I mean, like, people actually want to know that there's a doctor who has some faith that this person's not dying of horridness and obesity inside him. Like, I mean, it's possible. I mean, Donald Trump could be just decaying from the inside, and We would have no way of knowing.
He'd be the oldest president-elect, is that right?
Yes, that's right. And the healthiest. And when they went in further, like, do you really think he's the healthiest? Well, I mean, Roosevelt had polio. he went on just like listing off all these presidents. Like, who was it that he said? Like, Taft had some type of amoeba eating his brain. it was pretty impressive. But there you go. All right, folks, only the best people. That's Donald Trump only gets the best people. I mean, so much best people, you're going to be sick of it. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. I will take your IMs. See you on the fun half.